You are listening to The Perks of Being a Book Lover, a show featuring two friends who've been in the same book club for almost 20 years.
I'm Carrie, and I don't have anything to say because by the time this airs, I will be jet-lagged from Los Angeles, and I'm tired already.
And I'm Amy. My co-host Carrie says one trip a year with me is enough, and don't expect any more book festival trips with her in 2024. So now I am putting out feelers for a new book festival companion. Any takers?
Y'all have fun.
Am I that bad?
No, I just don't have an endless supply of money.
No, that's true.
I got a budget, sis. Basically, we're opposites, but we find common ground on our shared love of books. Each week, we chat about what we're reading with each other and sometimes a special guest.
We also dabble in other topics like books in the news, recent book-inspired films, our TBR counts, and general things that tease our brains. We're glad you're with us today. So this week, we have a remix episode because we are at the LA Festival of Books. We catch up with Ellen Burkett Morris. We first spoke to her in 2020 about her short story collection, Lost Girls, and now she has recently published a novel, Beware the Tall Grass. So we hear a little something old and a little something new from her in this episode. But first, another radio show host at the radio station where our show airs.
He sent us a link from lawnlove.com, and it was a list of 2024's best cities for book lovers. And do you know where Los Angeles ranks?
I hope it's in the top 10.
It is number 4.
Okay.
Number 4. Let's see. I'm going to click on, it says read the full story here. I want to see where Louisville is.
I'm looking up Lawn Love. It's a lawn care society. Why is a lawn care society sending?
That is weird.
We can't do something from Lawn Love.
I mean, it could.
where are they getting, like, they're doing surveys on where, I mean, where is this
well,
coming
hang
from?
On, hang on. Yeah, they did. They ranked it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Cincinnati is 19. Nashville is 21. Indianapolis, 33. I'm just hitting all the cities around us. Oh, boy. I'm past 50, and I don't see Louisville. Okay, we're in the top 100.
Well, that's good.
77. Out of 500. Out of 500 cities. Louisville okay. was 77.
Well,
so that's not too bad.
That's not too bad. But I am excited to be going to Los Angeles, which is number 4.
All right. So the rankings, what they did is they looked at the metrics that are most relevant to rank the best cities for book lovers. And then they weighted them and grouped them by these categories. Books for sale access, book rental access, special access, and community. And then they gathered data. And if you want to read this, go to Lawn Love, and they have a blog, and they have the whole methodology laid out. And, you know, I mean, their sources, they looked at AARP and Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America and National Library Service for the Blind and Urban Libraries Council. So it looks like they were, you know, trying to get a pretty broad sweep of data.
I just think it's odd that it came from a lawn care company, but you know, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it looks like they have all sorts of lists, like best cities for movie lovers and best cities for thrifting. Maybe it's their thing. You know, they try to appeal to people who maybe are interested in lawns, but have other interests as well.
Maybe.
I don't know. I don't work for them, but I'll take top 100.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Louisville has a little bit of work to do, but we'll get there, maybe.
Number one was New York City. I don't think that's any huge surprise because that's where the publishing world is based. I mean, it's hard to walk around there and not run into a bookstore.
Yeah, Chicago's 2, San Francisco 3, we said Los Angeles 4, and Seattle, Washington rounds out the top 5.
Okay.
So there you go. Your little nugget of useful or useless bookish information, however you want to look at it. From Lawn Love.
We'll tell you what. We will be in LA. We're recording this before we're actually in LA. we will sample all of the bookish delicacies that it has to offer, and we will report back. We will have an all new episode for you next week. Enjoy our episode with Ellen.
We are doing a remix episode, and we're happy to have past guest Ellen Burkett Morris on the show. So we spoke with her when her book of short stories, Lost Girls, came out in 2020, and she was a guest on episode 59 in September of that year. That feels like forever ago. She has now published her debut novel, Beware the Tall Grass, and we're interested to hear all about it. So Ellen, thanks for joining us.
Oh gosh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So much has happened since we talked to you the first time. First, well, of course, COVID. We talked to you in the midst of COVID, and you have been working on a novel, and it's out. It's out into the world. It came out a few weeks ago. So give our listeners just a little synopsis of what your book is about.
Yeah, absolutely. The very, very short synopsis is that it's about a mother's love and a soldier's courage and how the two things are connected. And it's a dual narrative, dual point of view story, alternating narratives between the mother of a young son who has past life memories of being in the Vietnam War and a young man in Montana who goes to war. So we go back and forth and back and forth between those two. And I will say that they meet. I won't tell you how they meet. But 8 years in the making. So
8 years?
Yeah.
Okay, so this wasn't a COVID book. This was a decade long book.
Yeah, it really was. I was in the car with my husband in 2014, and I heard this NPR story about this research program at University of Virginia, where they really attempt to authenticate the past life memories of really young children. And like if a kid says, well, I was on this ship on this date, and my best friend named Joe died, they'll go back and fact check it. And often the facts totally line up. And so it was just too intriguing. I was like, this is an idea here. And so I wrote a short story, got that published in the Upstreet Review. I went to a writing workshop with Erin Flanagan, the Antioch Writers Workshop. And she was the one who said, you know, this could be a novel. And I thought, well, yeah, who's going to write it? You know, but I sat with the idea. And, you know, I'm a short story writer by nature. So really the trick for me was to find that second point of view character so that I could sort of extend the storytelling and deepen it and make it into something really unique. And so once I found that, that was really the first step. And then, you know, writers groups, I had a mentor through AWP, Writer to Writer, who was immensely helpful. I got a literary agent who sent the book around, but who really didn't ask for edits, didn't do anything but send out my query letter. He just wasn't doing his job. So I had to, you know, I had to cease that relationship. And then ultimately, you know, I finally found my way into the story. And that's when I heard about the Donald L. Jordan Prize out of Columbus State University. Its purpose is American stories that deal with integrity. And I thought, wow, I think this is a match. And so I sent it to them and then heard that they selected.
So we just had an episode a few weeks ago about small presses and what a huge impact that they have in the publishing world and all the interesting things that come out of small presses. And so talk a little bit about your experience with Columbus State. That's an interesting program.
Yeah, absolutely. I've loved every minute of it. The guy who edits the series, it's Alan G. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop program. You know, he's been great. He was like, okay, you know, turn up the volume on this a little. I want to understand this a little better. Not major edits, but small, significant edits. He sat down with a group of students, which I absolutely love that idea. And they read the book and they had their own questions and edits. So it became a teaching tool. And I thought that was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, the small press world is really, really unique. And there's really exciting, wonderful work out there for those people who, you know, who frankly don't feel like playing the game of trying to find a literary agent, or they've been burned, you know, as I was burned, or or they want to have some level of control, because you really do get to, it's a collaborative editing process. They show you book covers and, you know, you get to have a say in that, you know, so it's an altogether different kind of deal. But yeah, it's been an absolute joy to work with them. I would say, you know, it's an academic press. Those are fantastic because generally they're supported financially. The press that my first book was with, you know, was an independently run operation. And from everything I'm hearing, they're completely falling apart. So do your research on the small presses. Check out Editors and Predators and Editors Beware, whatever that thing is called. And, you know, before you do anything, even if you have a friend who's had a book that was pretty successful with that press, things may change. But academic presses are pretty fantastic. And there's just such exciting work coming out from presses like University of Georgia Press, Tin House, Saraband, Here at Home. I mean, it's its own world. And it's a world I'm very happy to be a part of.
So I want to know, done poetry, but you've primarily done short stories. So what were the challenges of ramping up or doing it in a different way? And how did you sort of overcome those challenges?
Yeah. For me, it was like, if I contemplated the length that I would have to get to, I would be completely paralyzed with fear. So every day it was about, you know, this sentence, this paragraph, this section of the book. I literally wrote it. So the main point of view character, who's the mother, is Eve. The soldier character is Thomas. And I went in and wrote an Eve section, a Thomas section, an Eve section, a Thomas section. And what I felt like it helped me do was that there were sort of subconscious echoes between the two storylines. I was able to build things in. Oh, there's an image in this, or there's a word that's used here. I can put this in the next one so that they'll feel woven together in a way that might not have been achievable if I'd written one whole section and then had to go back and try to replicate that. You know, I jokingly say to people, it was like chipping away at a mountain with nail scissors. I mean, it really was. It was a slog to write this book. I've since drafted a second novel, and that was like swimming in a beautiful pool on the best summer day. You know, it was like, well, damn, that was a completely different experience. It was tough, but just, you know, trying to find the points of drama within the story, you know, and really just living with it long enough to figure out how to tell it would also be a thing. You know, people are eager to get their stuff out there, and I totally get it. But when you sit with it and you see what it becomes, you'll dive back into it and you'll find things that you never dreamed you might find. So that would be my advice, is just hang in there with it.
One of the things that I noticed about this book is because I read Lost Girls, which was your collection of short stories, and all of those were stories about women. And in this book, one of your viewpoints is from the point of view of a soldier serving in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And some of those scenes are, you know, fairly graphic as far as war imagery, right? It seems like a big departure for you as far as like what I have seen you write before. So how was that?
Yeah, actually, you know, and I've told this story before, when I wrote the book, when I was really working on the book heavy, my mom had just been diagnosed with lung cancer that would prove to be terminal. And I had just been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. So life was really, really hard and very much felt like a battle because we didn't know what was going to happen. Everything was up in the air. It was super tough. So strangely, turning my attention to an actual war scenario was kind of a escape. You know, and I was somehow in this dark mindset where I was able to deal with some of the stuff that would come out on the page. And, you know, I had spent 10 years as the editor of the Patton Saber, the newsletter of the Patton Museum Foundation. So I was used to a lot of World War II stories, but Vietnam is something else entirely and far more violent in a different way. So I just immersed myself in soldiers' blogs. I interviewed an uncle who'd been in Vietnam, and he talked to me about what it felt like to be in a foxhole at night when the air is so thick and the mosquitoes are on you and you know, the lights from the bombs are going over your head. I mean, it was just a total immersion. And as I said, you know, somehow easier than reality to dwell in those spaces. It was cathartic in a very, very odd way. And it was only recently that I thought, wait a minute, you know, there's such a strong parallel between what I was writing about and how things felt at that time. Hmm. And so I think that's one of the things that writing can do for us, is that we can kind of process our own stuff. We can cathartically on the page live out things that are challenging. So I really got into that, even though it was normally stuff I would never want to look at. You know, I don't watch horror movies. I don't watch war movies. You know, pretty much give me a comedy, but there I was. So
my cat apparently wants to ask you a question, Ellen. she keeps jumping on my lap. You were talking about the research that you did for the Vietnam War. I'm curious, did you read books or novels about past lives to build on what you had heard from that radio story?
No, I really didn't read a lot of past life stories. I really wanted to come at it fresh, and I wanted very much to come at it in a straightforward way. I didn't want to delve into the woo-woo aspects of it, but more like, if your kid came to you and said this crazy thing about napalm, what would you do? So I did look at a couple websites, you know, and what you find is there's like legit people who are like, this thing's happening, trying to make sense of it. And then there are other people who are sort of trying to offer up these mystical answers, you know, like the Long Island Medium and all this. And so that was interesting. I did look at some websites related to that. But more than that, I really started to think about what would be the steps you would take. Like, we're going to the doctor, we're going to the neurologist, we're going to the psychologist. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, the psychologist says we need to go to the past life regressionist. So, you know, it's like kind of taking people through those kinds of steps to figure out what was going on.
Our book club at one point read a novel about past lives, and it was such a great text to have a discussion about. And so I think that, you know, your book is another one that brings up all of these ideas that, you know, as a general rule, people don't think about on a day-to-day basis, but I think is ripe with content that people can mull over and discuss and debate. And so I know for like I said, our book club just really went to town on a book that had a similar vein. So yeah. I hope that book clubs find your book and go down their own rabbit hole with it, I guess.
Absolutely. Me too.
Are you also working on short stories at the same time that you're doing this?
Yeah, I am. During my COVID work was a series of short stories that dealt with themes of home. And so I've got a collection that I've tentatively titled Home Repair Manual.
I love that title.
Yeah, and that's out to some small presses and literary contests right now. So fingers crossed on that one. So,
all right. Yeah. Well, you're a busy lady. You have not let the last 4 years keep you down. You have been at it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you all so much. It's just such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it was great to talk to you again, Ellen. Best of luck with all your future short stories, novels, all of it.
Thanks.
Our guest this week, Ellen Burkett Morris, has an affection for small things. She says she was born prematurely and was terribly small at birth, and she wonders if this is where her fascination with beautiful things coming in small packages began. Ellen is the author of a book of poetry and a new collection of short stories called Lost Girls. What readers may notice about her stories is that though they are small in length, they are powerful in meaning. Each story focuses on a passing moment in the lives of the girls and women she writes about. Ellen says she loves dipping in and out of a person's story to find the small snippet of time that packs an emotional punch. Lost Girls has been receiving critical praise from such places as the Southern Review of Books, Alabama Public Radio, and numerous book bloggers and reviewers, including the Modern Mrs. Darcy blog. Ellen talks to us about why reading her favorite books as a girl formed her idea that to be a writer, you have to be a little like a spy, how the Me Too movement helped shape the final form her story collection would take, and why the superstore Target carrying her book left her a little gobsmacked.
It's late August, and we've got a guest today who is a Louisville native. She is a writer and poet, and her name is Ellen Burkett Morris. She wrote two books, Surrender and Lost Girls. And Lost Girls, I'm sitting here looking at it in front of me, and we're going to be talking about those books. So,
tell us just a little bit about yourself and your journey to becoming a writer.
Yeah, I was born in Louisville, and my father was a writer. And my mother was a nurse, and so I grew up watching him work, which as a kid looked like torture because he was at the table with the typewriter, and I was like running in and out, getting snacks, watching TV, going outside, and I thought, oh, that looks so boring. But really, what happened was that he was around a lot and read a lot and read to us, and books were everywhere, and I just soaked that in, and I did things like I wrote stories when I was a kid. I still have my first story that was on lined paper and bound with a ribbon. Then I worked for my high school newspaper. And then I tried to pursue a career in communications and spent like 10 years as an adjunct teaching public speaking and group process and interpersonal communication. And then I really figured out that I love to write and I wanted to write. And so I went ahead and started to find jobs that would allow me to write. So I was a freelance writer for a long time. I worked for the business newspaper for about a year before I figured I really couldn't stand it anymore. Now, when I was in my mid-30s, I said, oh my God, if you're going to do this, you've got to do it now. Totally afraid of failure. And I just plunged in. And so that's what really got me started with creative writing.
You mentioned that your father wrote detective or crime fiction.
Yeah. He had a detective that he created, Michael Reinhardt. And the two books he published were set in Louisville. And so that was a lot of fun. Those were in the 80s and 90s. You know, it was interesting to see him go through that process, get that out there and seeing people in the community excited for books that had a Louisville-based detective.
So I was envisioning when you were talking about being a kid and seeing him at work. I'm a freelance writer myself. And, you know, I was picturing you seeing him like tearing his hair out and having writer's block and stuff like that. So did he ever talk to you about some of those challenges, or was it primarily you were like, oh, you're just sitting there doing nothing. I'm outside having fun.
Yeah. You know, a lot of it was, it looked like homework to me, which is kind of funny, but he was pretty forthright about his own struggles with it, about procrastination, about laziness, which he sort of painted as a family trait. Which was pretty intimidating. But, you know, because of the career that I pursued and I ended up spending time working on deadline, I actually am very disciplined about my practice. And as a result of that, fairly prolific in terms of creating short stories and other kinds of work. And it's because every time I start to want to slack, I remember how much I disliked being in that corporate environment or how much I disliked writing about buildings for the business paper. So it's a great motivator.
So what kinds of books did you like to read when you were a kid?
Oh my gosh. Well, Harriet the Spy was a huge one for me. I loved it because she was what most writers are, which is a spy. You know, she was looking into the world, other people's windows, and trying to figure out what their lives were like. And so that was a huge one for me. I also liked it because there was a lot of stuff about her own emotional development and what it's like to feel outside of the center of things. So that was really good. A lot of Roald Dahl. James and the Giant Peach was something that I loved a lot. And Charlie and the Chocolate Factory were big books for me. And then I remember quirky books, like my dad got me this book called Arabelle's Raven about this girl who had this really irritating bird. He would often get me these books that had to do with children who were sort of troublesome. And I didn't know if he was trying to tell me something or not, but you know, I really, really always loved to read and still have a great affection for like that whole middle grade area of writing. You know, I think there's beautiful, sensitive work going on there. They're for kids that a lot of grown-ups don't know exist.
I know for myself, I read partly because I teach middle grades, but I read a lot of middle grade work. And just because they're not 500 pages and they're written for 12-year-olds, sometimes some of the best books I've read are middle school books that resonate. I do think that adults tend to feel about middle school books the way they sometimes feel about middle school children.
Right, right. Oh my gosh, so true. And there's beautiful stuff, as you said.
So talk to us a little bit about your new collection of short stories. It's called Lost Girls, and it's unified somewhat by theme. So all the stories take little snippets of different women's lives. And sometimes they're young, sometimes they're older. So when you sat down, or maybe it wasn't something that you sat down and said, I'm going to write this book. Maybe the stories came and then you saw that there was that connection between them. But tell us a little bit about when you started either writing it or figuring out that it all kind of went together.
So I started an MFA at Queen's University, Charlotte, North Carolina in 2012. And I had written some short stories before, probably starting around 2010. So pulling together, starting to write some short stories and all of this. And I had a concept for it. And it really was that I was telling the story of this male photographer from Boston who had traveled to Vietnam and taken pictures and who came back changed and somewhat empty and decided to travel through the American South to document the bicentennial. And he stops in this little town of Slocum, Kentucky, and it's about the connections he makes with the people in that town. So I had written this collection all around this male photographer, and I'd been sending it, and I was a finalist for a couple of publication prizes. But the truth is, nobody was in love with this somewhat quiet male photographer. And so finally, I figured out that really the most interesting people in the stories were the women in the stories that he was in, and that he was perhaps the least interesting thing about those stories. So I pulled him out of some of the stories. I toned him down in some of the others, and I set about really pulling together a collection that was about women and girls. What happened was I opened my file folder and started to look, and I saw that I really had enough stories that were good enough to build this collection centered around women and girls. And I will say that, you know, the Me Too movement was a big motivator for me. I mean, you know, I started to wonder why in the world was I focused on this male photographer, you know, that classic idea of the male gaze, men looking at women, when in fact the women in these stories were the ones who had really interesting life experience and who had really suffered and grown and learned and supported each other. And so it was like a eureka moment. And I just pulled those together and started to think about what order to put them in. And I had the story Lost Girls. I had written that long before. I'd probably had that for about 20 years. I wrote it first as a dramatic monologue. And I decided that that would be the title story, that it would come first, and then it would set that tone. This idea of sort of losing your way, and yet inherent in that, I think, is that we find our way again. And oftentimes, you know, by digging deep and finding our own resilience, and also by getting assist from the other people in our lives, particularly the other women in our lives. So I was really thrilled to see that that was there. I didn't try to get an agent. Agents are often really skeptical about publishing short story collections by unknown writers. So I sent it to small independent presses, and that's how it came to pass.
You know, I was an English major in college, so was Carrie, but we spend a lot of time as English majors looking for themes or symbolism or things like that. And you often wonder, does an author mean to put that in there, or are we searching for it? But it sounds like you wrote a lot of these stories, and then as you're looking back on them, you realize that there is a theme and there is some symbolism. And was that sort of a shocking moment in a way to think, oh my gosh, like I really did put that in there and I might not have even realized it.
It totally was. And it was the same thing with my poetry chapbook. Both times I inventoried what I had and was struck to find that there was some sort of thematic consistency there. So with the poems, that book is called Surrender. And those poems I wrote after my dad's death. And they were all about things like saying goodbye to people you love, facing middle age, facing health issues and things that you didn't anticipate. Surrendering to the stuff of being an adult, however resentfully and slowly I wanted to do that. But yeah, so in both cases, when I sat down with the material, it was like one of those smack your forehead moments. Like, oh my God, all of this has to do with surrender. Or wow, this really has to do with this concept of losing and finding yourself. And so yeah, it was a total shock.
You mentioned just a few moments ago about Slocum, Kentucky. So as I was reading Lost Girls, I kept seeing that name. And, you know, I looked up Slocum, Kentucky, and I didn't find any place. But it occurred to me that there's some small little places in Kentucky. So it could be someplace that exists. And just isn't on a map. So is it a real place?
It's not a real place. And in fact, you know, it's funny because I get this question a lot about these short stories. You know, did that happen to you? Is this autobiographical and is it real? And really, I'll borrow some details from my life, but really, it's very, very fictionalized. But what I've learned in workshops and things, you know, I took a workshop with short story writer Ron Carlson, who's just brilliant. And he talked about the importance of authentic detail in a story. And he said, if you are going to have a story and it's going to have two Shoneys in it that are a mile apart on a highway, you better make sure that these Shoneys are unique, that each one is its own unique place. So it really stayed with me that I needed to populate this fictional world with as much authentic detail as I could. I've been born and raised and lived in Louisville, but you know, my mother was from a small town. She was from English, Indiana. And I do think there's something about the idea of small towns, this presumption that everybody knows each other, when in fact, you know, everybody's got their own sort of private interior life. That's why I wanted to pick a small town as a setting, because I wanted there to be, here's what we think we know about each other, here's what's inside. You know, I wanted that contrast to be a part of the telling. I just think it's intriguing. I think we're fascinated with the secret lives of other people, you know, their hopes and dreams and fears and all of that versus what we see on the surface. So that's how Slocum came to be.
It's interesting. Sometimes I think that, at least for me, a lot of times I think about the idea of anonymity being something that can only really happen in a setting that's a big city. There's a lot of people around. And it's interesting, there can be a lot of anonymity, just a different form in a small town.
Yeah, it is. And too, I think there's some pressure that's put on people because of the closeness and proximity, and that they see each other and they have to see each other. They're part of a community. And that's something you don't feel as much in a really urban narrative.
So it was interesting the way that the book was put together, because the stories that are based with characters that live in Slocum are interspersed with other stories. And it's sort of like this through line that goes through the book, which I really like the feel of that, that the other stories could hitch themselves to it. But I want to talk about the very first story in your book. And it's one that's not based in Slocum. It's actually based on a true event that happened in Louisville in the 1980s. And anyone who grew up here, I did not grow up here, but Carrie did. And lots of people that I know of that in that age group remember the disappearance of a local teen girl near a mall, and she was never found. And so talk about why you made that your first story. And when it happened in real life, did it make a big impression on you?
You know, it made a huge impression. I lived on Bashford Manor Lane, which was the street where that happened. And so I lived in an apartment complex, and there was a field that you could cross through to get over to the mall where she disappeared. So it felt very much, you know, like it was in my backyard, like it had happened really, you know, right close to where I was living. And it made a huge impression. And it was so sad and tragic. And I think ultimately led to the creation of the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I think the thing is, it stayed with me in terms of this idea that when we talk about horrible historic things, we talk about never forget 9/11, don't forget the Holocaust. And I think that these small losses, these losses like the one that happened when somebody goes missing or is taken like that, not small, but personal losses, deserve equal remembrance. And so that was kind of what was behind that story. I wanted to explore how one girl could pay honor and tribute to another girl. And at the same time that I did that, I wanted that character to be complex. So she's got some strange emotions too. She's got some degree of envy in terms of the girl's parents and the attention that's paid to the girl. She feels sort of unseen. And so there's that weird thing in the mix, but ultimately there's this really strong desire to honor and remember the girl's legacy. And so that's what really drove the story. And I think having written poetry, started to think about images and objects. And so that's why at the end of that story, what you've got is on the girl's 21st birthday, a bottle of whiskey that disappears before morning. That works in so many ways.
Ellen, because I was 10 when that disappearance happened, and it was actually 1983 when that happened here in Louisville. And that happened in the summer. And then I remember watching, because I think it was shortly after that, the movie Adam, about Adam Walsh, who had been abducted, came out that same year. Yeah. And so reading that story brought back to me so many memories about that palpable fear. It was very strange for a very short story, you know, like I think it was 3 pages to take me back to a time that I had completely, you know, I mean, it's just not something that I think about. So right. It was pretty amazing. Right. Speaking of, you know, the 80s, a lot of your stories seem to be set in an 80s, late 70s feel to them. So talk a little bit about why that was the time period that you chose.
Yeah, I think that's purely because that was the period in which I was growing up and I was a kid and tapping into the memories of that time period for myself. So some of the stories will have particular pop culture references, watching Sonny and Cher on television and things like that. And those are really drawn from my own experience. I had a best friend that we'd get on the phone with each other and watch television together and make comments about things and do all of that. And so it was easy for me to recreate that fictional world for characters that age in a time period in which I was a kid. It was just an easy go-to for me to do that. I mean, I think that was a large part what drove me, you know, and then come to understand that readers really love pop culture references. There are certain things that really draw readers in, and that's one of them. Sex is the other one. You know, I took a poetry workshop one time, and I remember the person who, and I can't remember who said this, but they said all poems are about sex and death. Well, okay, there we go. Wipe your hands. We're done with that one. Figure that one out. So I do think that those kinds of things just hold inherent interest for people, and that was a big part of my making that choice.
I think it's like an instant nostalgia when you have pop culture references in there. Someone refers to a candy that you used to eat when you were a kid and maybe they don't make it anymore. And suddenly all those memories flood back to you. And I think that might be why people love that. It's the same reason why when you go to like a vintage market or flea market and you see something, you know, that was in your grandma's house. So like a particular dish or who knows what, you know, maybe she had that tablecloth and it just brings back all these memories flooding to you. So I love pop culture references.
I noticed when I was reading, this is the one that I specifically marked, the one in the story Skipping Stones, where it mentions Stewarts.
Yeah.
For me, that I was like, Stewarts.
So for people who don't know, what is Stewart?
It was a department store.
Fancy, yeah. One downtown.
You know, it for me, like that brought it home in a way that television reference or whatever, because it just felt different. Or sometimes writers, if they want to talk about a place, they sort of mention the big places that everybody knows about, you know, whether you live there or not. They might mention Churchill Down, but lots of people have heard of Churchill Downs. But if you grew up in a certain time period in Louisville, you would have known about Stewart's. So yeah. I thought that was really cool.
Well, that was really fun because my mom used to take me and my sister shopping there. And so right away, it was a special thing. So I wanted to designate how special this dress was that her mom took her to Stewart's to get it.
So I'm curious about where the ideas for your stories come from. Do you often start with just an image or an object? I mean, I'm sure they come from all different places, but tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's different for every story, but I'll pick a story that I think is kind of interesting because it started one way and then kind of morphed into something else. So the story Religion, which is about a virgin who joins a breastfeeders group accidentally and decides to stay. That story began because I wanted to explore the idea that social groups function like cults. Sometimes, you know, like if you get in them and you feel like you need to follow the rules and there are prescribed methods of behavior and there's pressure to behave a certain way. And I'd heard that about La Leche League stuff from friends. You know, if you weren't successful breastfeeding, you felt like a failure sort of thing. And so that was the idea that I started with. Let's have her enter a cult of another sort. But it's so appealing there that she stays, even though she's got every reason in the world to get up and leave. She's a total imposter. But these people are so warm and lovely. And what she sees in the room, she's so lonely that she just can't help herself. She comes back. You know, so I started with this broad concept, but really what I ended up with was this story that was satirical, but also very sad, all about loneliness. And it was the loneliness that came out, not the cultishness. That was what took over once the character was put in the situation and began to act and react. So that's interesting. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, you try to be open to what comes.
So that brings up an interesting point just about short stories in general. This is a fairly slim book. You can easily read it in a day or two, but it really packs a punch. And some of your stories are only two or three pages long. So how do you go about creating something powerful in a smaller space? And do you find that you can do things in a short story that maybe you couldn't do in a novel?
You know, I think without a doubt, you do things in short stories you can't do in a novel. With a short story, you get to decide when you dip in and when you jump out. So you get to decide when you enter and when you exit. And you get the opportunity to focus on peak moments, which is what I love when I'm reading, you know, those really powerful moments. I'm the kind of person who, if I'd go to church, I'd be sitting there, I'd be a little bored. And I think everybody around me is probably having a religious experience. Right now. So with short stories, you're able to really get that religious experience. You're able to get that peak moment, you know, and I love that. I think that having been a poet, get these tools for compression, like certain images, picking just the right word, you sort of hone your skills at compression because poems are such small contained vessels. For me, I think it is a function of that. It's a function of my work as a poet, perhaps my own impatience on some level, that desire to dwell in the really intense moment. Those are the things that really draw me to short stories.
You had mentioned your book of poetry, Surrender. What was it that made you decide to take the leap to short stories? Was there anything in particular?
I think the thing is, I really don't ever want to limit myself in terms of genre. And I think that what happens when I'm writing is that something tells me what it is. So I wanted to write an essay about me and my father watching the Rolling Stones on Saturday Night Live when I was a kid. And Mick Jagger goes over to Keith Richards and starts licking his lips. And my father freaked out. He just thought it was the grossest thing. And I sat there and I thought, wow, something exciting is happening right there. So I thought I was going to write this essay about the generational divide. And instead it became this poem called The Divide, where, you know, where I mentioned somebody listening to The Shadow on the radio and how that was their version of something that they were into. And then watching Saturday Night Live with him and our totally opposite reactions. And I really let the stuff tell me what it's going to be. I let the work sort of guide me as to what it's going to be. So by writing The Divide as a poem, I got to put in The Shadow. I got to put in the radio. I got to put in Elvis's voice trickling like sweat down a glass of iced tea. I mean, I got to do all kinds of stuff that wouldn't have worked in an essay.
I sort of love that idea of writing and sort of the mysticism of it. I mean, you often hear about writers say, well, the characters told me what was going to happen next or told me where the story was going to go. And that seems to be what you're saying in a way, not so much about your characters, but that the story sort of tells you what form it should take, whether it be a poem, an essay, a short story.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Well, it certainly worked for me. And so now I have a couple of novels in the works, and we'll see how that goes. But these were definitely things that needed to be told at Morley.
So your book has been receiving a lot of critical praise, and I'm sure you're thrilled about that. But you had mentioned on social media that you were geeking out to seeing your book available for sale at Target. And Target is such a touchstone of middle-class America, especially for women. So tell us a little bit about why that was so important for you.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I guess I was doing the online search that people do when they have a book out just to see what's getting noticed, what's on Google, what shows up where. And then I saw that it was available at Target, and I just felt gobsmacked by that. And you know, I think there are a couple things going on there. I'm sure there's a part of my brain that was like mass marketing, or, you know, lots of people going to Target. Woo! But then there's also this thing, I mean, the role of Target in my own life. You know, I don't go there now with the global pandemic, but Target was a place I would escape to, you know, on afternoons when I needed to take a break. And I would just really take my time and go down the aisle. So I'm rolling down the cereal aisle, picking out the fun, unusual cereal, and I'd roll through the candy aisle and I'd pick up the things that I wanted there. And then I would end up in that aisle with those books and just always felt like such a treat just to cruise the Target and pick up all this stuff that I really didn't need, but that felt good. Or you pick up the boring stuff that you need and then you go roll around and find the fun stuff. So yeah, it was really a ritual for me. So there was a great deal of satisfaction in knowing that they carry.
It's kind of funny. You had said that the stories tell you what form they want to take. Well, they say the same thing about Target. Target tells you what you need to buy.
Never heard that, but I need a t-shirt.
Are there any short story writers that are favorites of yours?
So because of the work that I do for AuthorLink, where I interview writers, I'm reading a lot of contemporary novels and not a lot of short story collections. I mean, you know, it would seem obvious for me to say Elizabeth Strout, but I'll say it anyway. Olive Kittredge, which really was novel and stories, just completely blew my mind. And it sort of took what Sherwood Anderson had started and made it into something else entirely. So beautiful, so deep. I was just sort of stunned by, you know, I started off reading really disliking Olive's character, thinking she was so prickly and awful. And by the end of it, Elizabeth Strout has her laying on a couch looking out a window. If I could have crawled up behind her and held her on that couch, I would have done it, you know. And I just thought, holy moly, what did she just do? How did I get to the place where I now love and have compassion for this character, this horrible, prickly character? You know, she's definitely a huge favorite of mine.
Reading your book of short stories, and I really loved it, and it made me want to read more collections of short stories. I haven't read them in a long time, and I really enjoyed it. I feel like I don't have to set aside an hour to read a novel. If I just have little snippets of my day, I can read a short story or two. So anyway, thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
We are going to take just a short break. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we're all going to talk about what we're reading.
But before we do, we're going to hear from a fellow book lover who's going to tell us about their most recent 5-star read.
Hello there. My name is Sarah Phillips from Cozy Midlife Book Nook, and I live in England in Newcastle upon Tyne. My favourite 5-star read recently is The Door-to-Door Bookstore by Carsten Henn, which has been translated by Melody Shaw. I fell absolutely head over heels in love with elderly Carl and young Shashka and their friendship. I found the story is incredibly heartwarming, and I am a sucker for books about the power of books. I found the character development just wonderful. It's explored through acts of kindness and acceptance, through which forges a gorgeous little community, helping to improve the lives of their characters. I would love to live in this community. This was actually my first foray into German translation literature, and it won't be my last. In fact, this book has been added to my self-care comfort books, of which the pile is ever growing for times when I need a hug in a book and no surprises. So you can find me on Instagram at Cozy Midlife Book Nook. I would love you to join me over there. And if you've read the book, I would love to know what you think or whether you are now planning on reading it.
And we're going to talk about what we're reading. And so, Carrie, usually we talk ahead of time, and I actually have no idea what you're going to talk about today. So what have you been reading?
So I have been on a little bit of a tear the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. You had read a book by this author, Mary Roach, a while back. The book you read was called Gulp.
Yes.
And it was something like Adventures Along the Alimentary Canal or something like that. Well, one of my neighbors was getting rid of some books, and the book is called Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. So that's by Mary Roach as well. And that is totally my jam. I love stuff about death. So I found this book so fascinating. I read it super quickly and loved it. So then I was like, oh, you know, I really like Mary Roach as a writer. I think I'm going to get another of her books. So then I got from the library a book that she wrote that's called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. I will say that I liked the book about cadavers better, which I think says less about Mary Roach and more about my personality, unfortunately for my husband. But so her books are what you might call narrative nonfiction or creative nonfiction. You know, she's talking about science or talking about biology, but she's doing it in a way that sounds like a story. It's not just like straight up facts or straight up dates or straight up names of researchers. There's a lot of humor, description, just a lot of the things that we love about narrative stories you can find in this book. So I wanted to share, I marked off a couple things, and this is the kind of stuff I was cracking up. And every time I read this, I crack up even more. So she has a chapter in the book Stiff, where she's talking about where the conscience of a person lies. And so like the ancient Greeks thought one thing and Babylonians thought something else. So she's talking about how they used to think, they said, you know, consciousness is in the heart. And then some people thought it was the brain. Did I say conscience? I meant consciousness. But it was, I think, the Babylonians who believed that the spark, the essence of what makes a person is found in the liver. And so she said that with classical Greece, the whole idea of the spark of what makes a person being in the liver went away. Most of her humor, or at least the stuff I end up cackling over, comes in her footnotes. And so she says, with the rise of classical Greece, the soul debate evolved into the more familiar heart versus brain, the liver having been demoted to an accessory role. And then she says, we are fortunate that this is so, for we would otherwise have been faced with Celine Dion singing, "My Liver Belongs to You," and movie houses playing, "The Liver is a Lonely Hunter." And so our book club had read The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, I think, last year. And so when I read The Liver is a Lonely Hunter, I just lost it, because mixing science and book humor is what I'm all about. And then I have to share something from the book Bonk. I'll pick the one that's more PG. There was one that I probably can't read on the radio. But she's talking about how researchers, of course, have used rats to study the dynamic of sex and reproduction. This is a chapter on female orgasm. And she says, if it's any solace, even female rats have trouble focusing. I give you a sentence, my favorite sentence in the entire oeuvre of Alfred Kinsey from Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Cheese crumbs spread in front of a copulating pair of rats may distract the female, but not the male. And I thought, yeah, I could probably be distracted by a nice cheese board that was set to the side. So anyway, you know, I mean, you definitely, you have to enjoy science. You have to, at least with the book about cadavers, you know, if you're squeamish in any way, don't read it. But I just think that she's a really fun writer who takes topics that could be extremely boring and just puts a lot of her unique personality into them. So I'm a big fan. Those are some of the things that I've been reading. Ellen, what have you been reading?
Yeah, I'm just finished a while ago, Lake Life by David James Poisson. And he's a fantastic writer. He's a great short story writer as well. But this is his debut novel. And it's a story about a family, the parents and their sons and their sons' spouses, and a particular weekend at a lake that's been their lake house forever. And each of the couples is in a moment of crisis. One of them has an unwanted pregnancy. The other one is grappling with issues of monogamy. And the other one is trying to heal from an affair that happened. And just got them at this lake. It's 3 days in their life, and the pressure is on as they try to sort these things out. It's really beautifully written. It was a really, really nicely done book. And it's a summertime read in that they're on vacation, but it's, you know, it's certainly not light. And you'll enjoy watching them as they struggle to reconcile all of their issues. So a kind of a book befitting our times, I guess. You know, the other thing I was interested in mentioning to you guys, you mentioned if I'd be interested in recommending a book that's not as well known as I think it should be. And there's a book called Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Rivka Brunt. I don't know if either of you guys have had a chance to read this one.
I have heard of it, but have not read it.
Oh my gosh. So this is 2012. I thought it was really a beautiful story. And it's about a 14-year-old girl whose uncle dies. And he was a really well-known painter, and they were very, very close. And it involves this legacy that he leaves for her. And just a beautiful story about love and about struggle. And it's just one that stayed with me for whatever reason.
So Amy, what have you been reading?
Well, 2012 seems to be a popular year because the book I'm going to talk about today also was published in 2012. But it's so funny, we were discussing this earlier about children's books being some of the best books. But I'm a person who, just until recently, I didn't want to read children's books unless I had a child to read them with. I obviously read them with my children, but it wasn't something that I was particularly interested in doing without a child to read it with. I just felt like I wouldn't get as much out of it as I would an adult novel. And then something changed, I don't know, in the last year or two. And we read several middle grade books in our book club. And I loved several of them so much that I started adding middle grade and young adult books into my regular rotation. And I have found that some of my favorite books have been books meant for those age groups. And especially during this pandemic, children's books have been a palate cleanser for me between adult reads that seem really heavy. So recently I picked up The One and Only Ivan by Catherine Applegate. And this book is a middle grade book, and it won the Newbery Medal for Outstanding Children's Literature in 2012. And it is the story of a very special silverback gorilla named Ivan, who was captured as a young gorilla, shipped to the United States, where he is taken in by a man named Max, who displays him at a roadside attraction along with an older elephant named Stella. And there's a stray dog who hangs around, and his name is Bob. And he spent many years in this cage at what they call the mall. And now he's no longer a cute baby. He's an adult gorilla. And he doesn't draw the large crowds he once did. And the weird mall is not doing well financially. And Max is cutting corners to save money. So to try to pull in more crowds, Max buys a baby elephant named Ruby. Now, Ruby is sad and she misses her family, but Stella, the older elephant, mothers her and makes her feel not so alone. But Stella wants a better life for Ruby than the one that she's had. And so she makes Ivan promise to help Ruby find a better life. She doesn't want Ruby to be the one and only, like she and Ivan are the one and only. So Ivan thinks of himself as an artist, and he often uses clay or mud to paint things on the walls of his cage. And Max sometimes will give him finger paints and paper, and whatever he produces is sold in the gift shop. So Ivan and Bob hatch a plan to help Ruby that involves his art and a little girl named Julia, who comes to visit every day when her father, the janitor, comes to work. So this story really just gutted me in the best kind of way. It gives you all the feels. You're mad, you're sad, you're happy. There are parts that are funny. It's all about friendship and being lonely and learning how to be you. And one of the things I loved most about it is the way it's written. And it goes back to a little bit to our other conversation we were having about being able to condense words and the sparseness of some writing being powerful. And this is very sparse. And it's from Ivan's point of view. And he is really a gorilla of few words. And each page may only have six sentences on it, with large spaces in between. But as we've been talking about today, that succinctness of Ivan's thoughts distills his feelings into really powerful statements. And there are just some really great lines in here. Like there's one where he's thinking about if he could be with other gorillas. And he says, "Is there anything sweeter than the touch of another when she pulls a dead bug from your fur?" You know, thinking about the way primates groom each other, you know. And he also says, "Gorillas are not complainers. We are dreamers, poets, philosophers, nap takers." Anyway, I just really love this book so much. I read this book for a few reasons. One, there's a new Disney Plus adaptation that just came out, and I wanted to see it, maybe. But now that I've read the book, I'm not sure if I want to see it because I'm worried they will ruin it. The previews show that they've added more animal characters. And while I don't necessarily think that an adaptation has to follow a book exactly, I'm a little skeptical. Also, there's a sequel out. So Sam Miller, our bookseller friend from Carmichael's, told us about it in our summer reading episode. The sequel's called The One and Only Bob. And if you remember, Ivan's friend, the stray dog, is named Bob. And she said that the second one is just as good as the original. It's interesting because this story is based on a true story of a gorilla who this happened to. And he went from being in a roadside attraction to then living in the Atlanta Zoo. So I gave this book 5 stars. And to me, it's a must read. And it's great for adults, too. Now, you know, I'm not big on giving trigger warnings, but I mean, I'm an animal lover and it made me feel sad, but it didn't bother me. But there are some very sad parts with animals in it. So if that's something that you don't think you can get past, it may not be a book for you. But I just thought it's so touching.
Something about those books with animals just hits you where it hurts.
I've read The One and Only Ivan and I'm going to totally look up that sequel. Can't wait to read that.
Yes. One and Only Bob. And I think Bob looks a little bit, I've seen pictures of your new dog, and I imagine it looking a little bit like your dog, like a scruffy little terrier type of dog.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. All the more reason for me to rush and get it.
You can find Ellen on her website at ellenburkittmorris.com and on Instagram at ellenburkittmorris.
For show notes for any episode, go to our website at perksofbeingabooklover.com. We're also on Instagram at perksofbeingabooklover pod and on Facebook at perksofbeingabooklover. To send us a message, go to our website and click the contact button.
If you enjoyed listening to us each week, tell a friend or write us a review on your favorite podcast platform to help other book lovers find us.
Finally, a huge thank you to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, a grassroots community radio station in Louisville, Kentucky. You can find our show there, live or in archives, at forwardradio.org.